Chapter 3. It is said that, when the teacher appeared, those of all castes went to hear his teachings, as well as animals, gods, and an occasional saint, to come away improved and uplifted. It was generally conceded that he had received enlightenment, except by those who believed him to be a fraud, sinner, criminal, or practical joker. These latter ones were not all to be numbered as his enemies, but on the other hand, not all of those improved and uplifted could be counted as his friends and supporters. His followers called him Mahasamatman, and some said he was a god. So, after it was seen that he had been accepted as a teacher, was looked upon with respect, had many of the wealthy numbered as his supporters, and had gained a reputation reaching far across the land, he was referred to as Tathagatha, meaning he who has achieved. It must be noted that while the goddess Kali, sometimes known as Durga in her softer moments, never voiced a formal opinion as to his Buddhahood, she did render him the singular honor of dispatching her holy executioner to pay him her tribute, rather than a mere hired assassin.
There is no disappearing of the true Dhamma until a false Dhamma arises in the world. When the false Dhamma arises, he makes the true Dhamma to disappear. Samyutta Nikaya 2.224.
Near the city of Allendale, there was a rich grove of blue-barked trees, having purple foliage like feathers. It was famous for its beauty and the shrine-like peace of its shade. It had been the property of the merchant Vasu until his conversion, at which time he had presented it to the teacher, variously known as Mahasamatman, Tathagatha, and the Enlightened One. In that wood did this teacher abide with his followers, and when they walked forth into the town at midday, their begging bowls never went unfilled. There was always a large number of pilgrims about the grove, the believers, the curious, and those who preyed upon the others were constantly passing through it. They came by horseback, they came by boat, they came on foot. Allendale was not an overly large city. It had its share of thatched huts, as well as wooden bungalows. Its main roadway was unpaved and rutted. It had two large bazaars and many small ones. There were wide fields of grain, owned by the Vaishyas, tended by the Sudras, which flowed and rippled, blue-green, about the city. It had many hostels, though none so fine as the legendary hostel of Haukana in Far Maharatha, because of the constant passage of travelers. It had its holy men and its storytellers. And it had its temple. The temple was located on a low hill near the center of town, enormous gates on each of its four sides. These gates, and the walls about them, were filled with layer upon layer of decorative carvings, showing musicians and dancers, warriors and demons, gods and goddesses, animals and artists, lovemakers and half-people, guardians and devas. These gates led into the first courtyard, which held more walls and more gates, leading in turn into the second courtyard. The first courtyard contained a little bazaar, where offerings to the gods were sold. It also housed numerous small shrines dedicated to the lesser deities. There were begging beggars, meditating holy men, laughing children, gossiping women, burning incenses, singing birds, gurgling purification tanks, and humming prayomats to be found in this courtyard at any hour of the day. The inner courtyard, though, with its massive shrines dedicated to the major deities, was a focal point of religious intensity. People chanted or shouted prayers, mumbled verses from the Vedas, or stood or knelt or lay prostrate before huge stone images, which often were so heavily garlanded with flowers, smeared with red kumkum paste, and surrounded by heaps of offerings, that it was impossible to tell which deity was so immersed in tangible adoration. Periodically, the horns of the temple were blown. There was a moment's hushed appraisal of their echo, and the clamor began again. And none would dispute the fact that Kali was queen of this temple. Her tall, white stone statue within its gigantic shrine dominated the inner courtyard. Her faint smile, perhaps contemptuous of the other gods and their worshippers, was, in its way, as arresting as the chained grins of the skulls she wore for a necklace. She held daggers in her hands, and poised in mid-step she stood, as though deciding whether to dance before or slay those who came to her shrine. Her lips were full, her eyes were wide. Seen by torchlight, she seemed to move. It was fitting, therefore, that her shrine faced upon that of Yama, god of death. It had been decided, logically enough, by the priests and architects, that he was best suited of all the deities to spend every minute of the day facing her, matching his unfaltering death gaze against her own, returning her half-smile with his twisted one. Even the most devout generally made a detour rather than pass between the two shrines. And after dark their section of the courtyard was always the abode of silence and stillness, being untroubled by late worshippers. From out of the north, as the winds of spring blew across the land, there came the one called Ryld, a small man, whose hair was white though his years were few. Ryld, who wore the dark trappings of a pilgrim, but about whose forearm, when they found him lying in a ditch with the fever, was wound the crimson strangling cord of his true profession. Ryld. Ryld came in the spring, at festival time, to Allendeal, of the blue-green fields, of the thatched huts and the bungalows of wood, of unpaved roadways and many hostels, of bazaars and holy men and storytellers, of the great religious revival and its teacher, whose reputation had spread far across the land. To Allendeal of the Temple,